Welcome back to Following Know It on Stormlight Podcast. This week is episode 218, and we are wrapping up Tress of the Emerald Sea by Brandon Sanderson. Not only do I have Paul and Elliot joining me, but once again, we have Alex joining us as well for our Tress wrap-up episode. Alex, how are you?
I'm doing good. Excited that you guys have now all read it, and now we get to talk about it.
Yes, it took your husband a year and a half to read this since it came out, so you finally get to discuss it with him, and no more spoiler screen for Paul. Paul, how are you?
Fantastic. I think the wrap-up episodes in general are always my favorite. I love kind of zooming out, looking at the book and the story as a whole, talking about it. I've already been roasted by Alex mildly for my ratings of the book, but we'll get to talk about it further. But always love these episodes and really excited to have Alex join us, of course, for this as well.
I was going to say, everybody has a 10 out of 10 somewhere on this rating chart, except for Paul. But we'll get to that in a second. Elliot, how are you?
I'm doing great. As I was trying to get my thoughts together for this whole book together, totes, as we've called it, I think that the simple adjective of just enjoyable seems to apply to so much of it. Is it, you know, going to be my favorite Brandon Sanderson work? No, I don't think so. But I can't help but describe it as all round enjoyable.
I agree. Let's roll intro, and then we can wrap up the entirety of Tress of the Emerald Sea.
Okay.
And I included it last time, so I'm going to include it this time as well in the episode.
I can't resist a good joke. Y'all should know this at this point. And by good joke, I just mean any joke that I think of in front of me. It does not have to be good. The criteria for good is very low.
I think we just need to replace the whole orchestra with just Paul humming, and we're good to go.
I think we've done that at some point, maybe.
We have done that for one episode. And it's beginning to be copyright struck, so I might have to actually change our intro music. So, anyway.
I volunteer if you need a voiceover.
Okay.
I can recreate an original version.
All right. I'm going to start with my ratings of the book, and then I will throw it to probably Elliot, and then let Paul and Alex round it out for us. Just real quick. I'll go through mine. We rated this in five different categories. If you haven't seen one of these episodes before, plot, characters, world building, theme, and point of view. All of those out of 10 for a total out of 50, which if you round to your 10, that gives you a rough 4 out of 5 score. So mine goes plot. I gave it a 6 out of 10. Characters and world building, I gave a 9 out of 10. Theme, I gave an 8. And point of view, I gave a 10. For a total of 42 out of 50. We can get into more detail after we give our scores. But Elliot, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm very curious about some of your scores, actually. But I'll share what mine are for the book. In plot, I did 8. Characters was 8 as well. World building was 10. If I could give it 11, I think I would. Theme 7, that was my lowest. And then point of view 8 for a total of 41 out of 50.
Paul, you want to go?
Yeah, I'll go, and then I'll let Alex end on the happier note. I think I had the lowest score, but only by 1. Trevor was a 42, Elliot was a 41, I totaled at a 40. I had plot at an 8, characters at a 7, world building at a 9, and then theme and point of view both at an 8 out of 10. We'll talk about those more in detail because I have specific reasonings. But I'll let Alex go.
Yeah, so for plot, I had a 9. Characters, I had a 10. World building, I had 8. Theme, I had 10. And point of view, I had 7, for a 44 out of 50.
I think this may be one of our most varied ratings overall. Some people have like perfect 10s, where others it's like the lowest score on their card. Yep. And so I'm curious to talk about this more. Trevor, unless you had something else you needed to point to first, I want to know why plot was a 6. That's a pretty low plot score.
It's the lowest score on this whole board, actually, a 6. And you're right. So each of you gave an 8, an 8, a 9, and I give a 6 for plot. And here it goes. It's fine. And I'll just say that it's fine. It is not where this book excels. I am not really looking forward to exactly what's happening next. I am just enjoying each scene as they come. And it's not the plot that I'm enjoying. It's the characters in the plot. It's how I'm presented the plot is why I'm enjoying this book. The plot itself, Tress going and rescuing Charlie from the sorceress and her several quests along the way, it's fine. It does not excel anywhere. There are no real low points. 6 out of 10.
Even though there was a dragon, that's worth at least 7 points for a dragon in the book. Come on.
And the dragon pulls it from a 5 to a 6.
Okay. I'll take it.
If we're kind of going by topic here, I'll weigh in with a couple of plot thoughts. I do think the story was not overly strong in the plot, but I kind of scored it for what it's intending to be. And I wasn't expecting a book like this to be super plot driven or have the most genius high stakes plot. It was kind of the opposite. It almost didn't matter what events were unfolding. It was more about how Tress was perceiving the world and the individual like decisions that she was making, and not the impact we were having on the planet as a whole. And so for me, I did 8 because that felt like kind of dropping it down below maybe some of our more epic plots, but I kind of bumped it up a little bit just because I didn't think it was intending to be more grandiose than it was.
For me, I definitely enjoyed the plot. I didn't have any major complaints about the plot or anything super negative. It's a bit different in scale from our other stories. It's less grand, Cosmere, massive scale, massive twists, things like that. It was kind of just a little pretty story in a pretty little world, you know? And so it was really fun. I wonder if, so Alex had the highest plot rating at a 9, and I'm going to slightly expose her here. This isn't exposing or embarrassing, but we predicted going into the story fairly early on, Elliot predicted that Huck was Charlie. And for Alex, that was a big, that was a reveal like later in the book. And I feel like that would be more exciting if you didn't, you know, maybe know that and that was a reveal. But I don't mean to throw you under the bus. I think that's perfectly fine. But
no, it's fair. Whenever, you know, I was, you know, asking Paul, how's the book going? How do you like it? And he was like, oh, yeah, no, Huck is definitely Charlie. And I was like, what? That was like a big reveal. And then in hindsight, because I reread it while you guys were reading it, just so it was fresh on my mind, I was like, oh, it was so obvious. And I felt so stupid. But I was like, but it was still a fun reveal for me. But it, in hindsight, you know, hindsight being 2020, but it was very obvious that he was Charlie. And I feel a little silly, but I enjoyed the reveal.
Alex, let me ask you this question. What is the speed that you read this book?
The first time I read it, it actually took me a while. It took me, I'd probably say the course of like, oh, no, it was like 2 years ago, but it was, I think, over a minimum 2 weeks, at most a month.
Okay. Because, so I read this over a couple days, and the Huck reveal took me by surprise. And we've talked about this on the podcast before, but if you sit and stew on some teasers that Sanderson puts in his books, you can actually pick them apart like we do on this podcast and figure them out. But if you're just speed reading, a reveal like that could easily go over your head and you're more enticed by the spores and what, you know, Tress becoming a pirate and all the clues that Huck is indeed Charlie would just go right over your head. So I assumed that you would have read it faster than that if you had missed Huck being Charlie, but if you weren't like super invested in it, put it down, picked it up, I could see that too.
And I mean, I was still, and I'll bring this up a couple of more times just as we're going through it, but where I was in my Cosmere journey, I didn't know to look for things like that. Like this was, I think, the fourth book that I read in his like whole Cosmere. It was two from Stormlight, Warbreaker, and then this. And so I didn't even think to look through. And I think that also, again, as we talk through it more, that's going to also affect a lot of how I view this story, being a novice in the Cosmere on the whole.
You can even parse out that he's Charlie in the first scene that you see Huck, which Elliot and Paul, you grabbed it from like the third scene that you see him. But at the beginning of the book, in the first chapter, we get introduced to Diggins Point, and locals call it the Rock. And the first scene that you see Huck in, he refers to it as the Rock and not Diggins Point. So immediately, if you're paying attention, you can figure out that he is at least a local of Diggins Point. But let's go back, or let's push on to characters. So my claim, the plot does not drive this book. The characters drive this book. I don't care what they're trying to work through. The characters are great in this book. And I love all the conversations between Ulam and Tress and Huck and Tress, and as she's getting to know the crew, I enjoyed all of that. I don't really care what they were doing. The dialogue and the character interaction was great.
I agree with you, I think, in principle, quite a bit. Characters was more a driving point than plot, for sure. I was thinking about the characters of this story, though, kind of up against the backdrop of Yumi. And I won't drop anything too spoilery for Yumi, but Yumi is another one that we talked about that's very character-driven. And I thought that this book actually suffered slightly in that in many of the sequences, we've got a really good character, but we only have one. At times, it really felt like it was only Tress that was really getting the full treatment and exploration of their character. And all the rest were very supporting cast, but I thought Yumi was fantastic in that we had a duo and you were kind of playing off each other and you had this relationship between two characters that was really blossoming and growing. Whereas I think Tress maybe didn't quite live up to that for me because it was at times just Tress. And so I rated it like slightly lower than Yumi because of that one reason.
You go ahead and go first.
Okay.
Yeah. All the characters.
Yeah, I rated it a 10 just because the reason why I love this book is because of Tress. And I think the characters are really charming I think the whole book, when you look at it, again, like comparing it to other Cosmere works, it's very, I don't feel like simple is the right word, but it's not complicated. Like specifically in comparison to all the other stuff. And so just, I liked the straightforwardness and just like the realness of the characters. Like they'd be a group that I'd want to hang out with. And I mean, Tress is, I totally get what you mean about not having like that, somebody to grow with and to have that, what is it, like, I guess, energy? What's the word? Yeah. The chemistry to play off of two people. But I liked her individual. It was very an independent story of like, she kind of just had to sit through and process a lot of this herself. And so we kind of get to, you know, we get Hoyd kind of giving a little bit of deeper information and just like what's kind of going around and like some commentary about it and like a social standing for them. And I liked her independent story in a different way, because I loved Yumi as well, if for that reason as well. But I liked her independent story, and again, I think all the characters are charming in really unique, fun ways. And I liked everybody's little quirks, and I just love them.
Maybe I shouldn't have gone last. I know, I feel bad because this is my lowest rating out of all of them. Yeah. And it's not that I dislike any of our characters. I think Tress is a fantastic character. I think Tress on her own is a solid 9 out of 10 as a character. I think Tress is wonderful. For me, the reason that I rated this book lower for the character score, 7 out of 10, I'm taking away 3 points because I think all the supporting cast in this book just doesn't live up for me. In my brain, the characters in this book are Tress, Huck, Hoyt as the narrator, maybe an honorable mention of Ulam, and that's it.
The Dugs.
The crew members, I couldn't, we just read the book. There's nothing memorable to me about like any of them. Elliot, you mentioned Yumi, and I also won't say much about Yumi, but there's like kind of a friend group. There's kind of a supporting crew of people.
It's literally a pirate ship of a crew.
Yes, but
a crew of people.
I couldn't tell you what any of them did or anything.
That's not their fault.
but to me, they were all very like, who was that again? Why do I care about them? What's relevant about them? I'm being pretty savage towards the other crew members, but I get myself in hot water the most talking about maybe secondary, tertiary characters, RE, Bridge 4. Anyways, what was I saying? Oh, Yumi. There is another, there's like a crew of kind of background characters, but to me, like, it's been a while since we've read Yumi, but I can remember a lot of the characteristics of those characters. I probably couldn't spell all their names correctly or tell you all the names, but I remember like the stereotypes about their characters and the personalities that they had generally. You know, I remember those things. Those kind of stuck out to me. In this, none of those characters stuck out to me. I really don't remember any like quirks or things like that. Maybe that is partly my fault.
It is.
but that's why to me this felt like Tress alone. Like Tress was fantastic. And there were cool things, like we got a dragon. That was a cool character. But the whole crew, it just didn't really land for me. It didn't feel like there was a lot of character there. So,
all right, Paul, I will say this. On my first read of this book, I was 100% with you. On a reread, I think Soleil and Fort specifically stand out really well. So I think if you were ever to revisit this book and begin to pay attention to those secondary characters, because they would impress you, because I was right there with you. When I finished the book, I was like, okay, Hoyt specifically told me who was the important crew and who was not. Because anybody who's not important, he named Doug. And anyone who was important, he named. And I still didn't feel like they were super important. But on a second read, I think the very subtle journey that Fort and Soleil go on, less so Anne, but Fort and Soleil, I think, are actually very good characters.
I think Anne's story's so sweet.
Fine. It's fine.
So what is Anne's story?
She just had bad eyesight. All she wanted to do, it was this simple pleasure of just firing a cannon, and it was like everybody's little quirks that they love.
Cannon girl. I remember her now.
Anyway, she has a really great story.
I'm going to detour us for a second. Well, I'm going to do our categories out of order here because I think this will tie together. Point of view. I want to talk about that super quick. I think that the narration style of the story and Hoyd's wittiness and constantly throwing in the offhand remarks and you kind of having to learn your narrator as a character as well. I wonder if that distracts the first time reader away from some of our supporting characters. Like, I wonder if when you're coming back for the second time, you've already heard all of Hoid's jokes he's going to crack. And so you can actually pay attention to Soleil and Fort a little more. Whereas the first time, I wonder if the narrator actually is a little bit drawing your attention and you don't see the supporting characters as much. I kind of factored something like that into my score for point of view. I thought it was a really exciting story where we were getting to see a lot of things unfold, and watching Tress develop and kind of see the world through her eyes was great. I do think that this style of narration with the constantly cracking jokes Hoid is fun, but also does, I don't know, it's not quite my cup of tea. I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, I'm going to add on that one because that was my lowest score, was the point of view, because I love the wise commentary. So this is going to be a little bit of extra, I'm sorry, but I have this thing that I get so mad and I don't love it when there's something really epic or something really cool or something really deep, and then it gets cut by something like slapsticky. My prime example is Kung Fu Panda 2. Whenever he has it's the Zen Ball Master theme and he's like inner peace and he throws a Zen ball and he has this like beautiful epic moment, the music's swelling, and then he looks down and his hand's on fire and he runs around like a chicken with his head cut off and ends up just sticking it in his mouth. And it completely cut the scene for me because it lost its epicness because of a slapstick humor that I didn't think was necessary. It didn't add nor detract from, it kind of detracted from the story. And so that's what I had a hard time with some of the jokes. Like, I loved when Hoid would give some commentary. I was telling Paul before this, I was like, I feel like this book was really just an opportunity also for Brandon Sanderson to just share a lot of insight that he has just about the world into this book. But then he would cut it with being like, yeah, but I'm wearing socks and sandals. What a dork I am. And it's like, it felt disconnected to me. And so sometimes I loved it, but for the little wits like that, I would agree that I think it detracted from the story a little bit.
Paul, do you have something to add before I get on a soapbox?
Not too much. I kind of agree with a bit of it. I like the Hoid commentary. I like the quick jokes and stuff like that, but it felt almost a little over the top for me. It was almost harder to follow. Maybe it would have been easier reading versus audiobook to kind of tell what's his, this is the most I've ever had a narrator talk to me. You know, normally the narrator is like, so-and-so said this in this way, not like going off on complete tangents to you about X or Y or Z real world experience or something like that. So it was a bit off-putting at times maybe, but overall I enjoyed it. I don't know if I would change it too much, but there I could find some complaints and problems. I had it at an 8 out of 10. It was good, but it wasn't my favorite. I didn't penalize points for this, I don't think, but the highlights of point of view for me are whenever we're able to see a wide range of character points of view in other books and kind of how they differ, how they come together, just ways like that, I think is really fascinating and neat and something that Brandon does very well. But in this book just didn't have that as much since we're primarily following one character throughout.
Okay. I agree with you, Paul. Splitting point of views and then having them converge is something Brandon does very well. Didn't happen at all in this book. However, if we're going to be scaling point of view in this book, we're obviously going to be talking about the Hoid narration, as you guys have. Like, it is so front and center in this book that it's impossible to really scale point of view without directly talking about that. So, 10 out of 10. And here's why. I am not saying that I would like every Brandon Sanderson book to be this. This is not a wish list 10 out of 10. Like, this is what I've been always hoping for. We're going to go completely out of order on this outline that we made because I'm going to be jumping down to general thoughts here. As Tress of the Emerald Sea as a writing tool is fascinating. And if you're a budding writer, if you're trying to if you're an experienced writer, and this is what Brandon's doing, trying to experiment with something new, I think this is really, really cool. And the way he pulls it off, Alex, you kind of said this, it distracts from Tress. The Hoid saying, I've got socks and sandals on because I'm a bozo, that absolutely distracts from Tress and Elliot, like you were saying, Soleil and Fort and Anne. It subtracts from the story. It does. However, I'm a huge Hoid fan. So that has to be a prerequisite to give this a 10, because if you're not a Hoid fan, I could totally see this. I could see point of view being a 4 and the rest being like really high, because Hoid just ruins the story for you. But letting Brandon Sanderson really run with this idea of Hoid talking to you as a reader while he's telling a story is really, really cool. And I really enjoyed it. I would not like this at all in a Stormlight book. If I have Dalinar giving this epic speech on the top of the tower, and then Hoid's like, yeah, and if I was there, I would have said this. It would absolutely ruin the story, of course. But because of what Tress is trying to do, Elliot, you kind of touched on this earlier, for what it's trying to do, I think Hoid as narrator, very abrasive, is really, really cool. And I enjoy that Brandon, 20 years into published writing, well, 18, 17, 17 years into published writing, he is still pushing himself to try new things, anticipate, like, I want to use this tool in the future. I'm going to write an entire book to see how it turns out. Oh, it turned out really well. I'm going to publish this. That's really cool to me. So that's why I put 10 out of 10 for this specifically. If it was anywhere else, I don't remember if I gave what I gave Yumi. Maybe I'll go look it up. But for Tress, it's 10 out of 10. For Yumi, I don't think it was a 10 out of 10. But there you go.
I think that's a really great point, Trevor, and something I hadn't necessarily thought about. Elliot had world building as his 10 on this, and I'm curious to know that. I think I kind of understand your reasoning. Like, I could guesstimate why you would have it as a 10, but I want to hear your thoughts.
Because he's a science nerd.
Ooh, yeah.
Yeah.
You.
After he did his cannonball diagram, was over. World building a 10 out of 10.
Pretty much. Yeah, Trevor just got all excited about a point of view in Hoid. Now my turn to get excited about the science. And it's so much more than that, though, which is why I said 10. And honestly, I'd go high. Like, breaking the scale actually breaks math. It doesn't work that way. But 11 out of 10 would be a decent score here, just because I think everything he does with the world building in this book is really, really well done. It's not as in-depth as maybe some of his other stories or his planets. There are more details in the lore you can get into on Scadrial or Roshar, one of those. But on this planet, he does such a good job of grabbing your interest. A planet covered in oceans of not water, with many different bright colors that are falling down from the moon. Oh, and all of these oceans are also part of the magic system that play into all these different really creative ways that you can use them. You put water on the zephyr spores and you can create explosions. The pink ones create these kind of crystal structures. Like, just so creative. And he's meeting a bar that I think he himself has set. And that alone is impressive, because you said it, Trevor, he's been writing for 17 years. He's been really creative and really clever in his world building elsewhere. And I constantly have kind of getting the feeling like, how is he going to top that? How is he going to top that? And here we go. This book is full of like super cool new ideas that are so different from everything else that we've done. The guy just keeps cranking out the genius ideas when it comes to how a world could be structured and work, and the economics of that world and the politics of that world. This book doesn't go as in depth on everything, but man, is it interesting. Really, really interesting. And for that, it hits it out of the park for me.
I do want to add to that, because world building was my highest rating. of my five. I gave it a 9 out of 10. And it's for a lot of the reasons you mentioned, Elliot. For me, it's so, like, the visuals of this world are really enticing to me. The different colored seas, how each of them interact differently, like the different colored spores interact with water differently, or all sorts of things, right, is really fascinating. And it created such a crazy picture. I really think one of the moments that sold me was when they were learning about the Crimson Sea, and that the rain over the Crimson Sea shoots up these spikes that go way up. They, you know, the spores expand and shoot up these spikes, and then those spores sink, the solid spikes now sink down. And I spent so much time just trying to picture that, and it was just crazy to me. And it was very, very neat. And so this is one of the coolest planets, I think, that Brandon Sanderson has written, and is really neat. So I definitely agree with that. I don't know if Trevor or Alex have notable thoughts on that. If not, or afterward, I'm curious to briefly talk about theme, because Alex had that as a 10 out of 10, where the rest of us did not.
I do have something brief to say about world building. I give it a 9. And everything that you said, Elliot, the world he has made is awesome. And he thoroughly explores it well, and it plays into the plot well. He overplays his hand by one point, and it's the ethers. The ethers and how they interact in the second half of the story, I think the ethers actually take away from our characters and what they're going through. Because you get really, really I got really distracted by learning about these ethers, figuring out the mechanics of them, trying to understand. And I forgot about, you know, what Fort and Tress and Huck, I forgot what they're going through. And so when we bridge that gap back to the plot and what actually matters in this book, I think it's a one step too far of world building in your face. It's great, but I think it actually detracts from the rest of the book.
Briefly, I want to say why I took a point off as well, because I just sang it his praises super high. For me, the hardest part for me to wrap my head around is, how do people actually exist on this world? So little of it is land. And I'm like, they've got to be getting water from somewhere to live. It's my understanding. And then these spores are extremely deadly, and they're just kind of floating around everywhere, that I'm like, this might be the scariest planet to just exist on. And I feel like maybe it's almost too treacherous that I can't hardly believe people are here and living. So anyways, felt like the danger factor maybe bit off more than it could chew. But with that said, I'll let Alex talk about theme first, I guess, and what you loved about the theme.
Oh, yes, we would be happy to. One of the reasons I love this book is because of the themes. And I think the themes kind of, it could probably play into a little bit of plot and character, but I think like the general just theme of the simple yet, you know, overarching theme is girl falls in love, decides to do something about it, goes to save the man. And then in the middle of that, though, there's this beautiful, it sounds so, I don't know, like Tumblr-y to be like, in the middle, she discovered herself. But in a sense, she does. She goes and she goes to figure out, the whole point of the book is not for her to go find herself, but she does along the way. And I think that that is really neat. And I think it's a cool exploration of, you know, there's all those rom-com movies or just stories of like, I don't even, you know, Runaway Bride, where she's like, I don't even know what type of eggs I like. And so she goes to discover what eggs she likes. Like, this isn't that. It just was a nice side effect. And I liked the theme of that, of, you know, going out and discovering and trying things. And it may not be for the reason that you're trying them. Like, again, she was trying to just get to Charlie. But in the meantime, she discovers that she can be an awesome captain of a crew who's not afraid of the spores. And that would have never been something that she would have discovered. And that's even one of the quotes that I really like of, she was like, who would have she, there's no telling who she would have been if she had stayed on the rock. And so I think there's just this overall theme of adventure and exploration that's buried in a deeper theme of just, you know, true love conquers all type of thing, of like the love that she has being what drives her. And so I loved the themes on the whole. And I also recognize this is a theme that speaks very deeply to me and a theme that I very much like and can relate to. And so people have different opinions. I'm not offended, but this is just, these are my thoughts. Love this book. Love the themes.
Yeah. I think that was really well said. I haven't heard that, or maybe I have at some point, but I definitely haven't heard that in full. And I think that's a really good point. I feel silly talking about the theme now. Maybe we should have had you end the theme talk. I don't have too much to say on the theme of this book. In my brain, I'm comparing this largely to a lot of the other books we've looked at. I don't think it's the only book I've rated as a 10, but what I think of as far as the Brandon Sanderson books regarding theme is, I think of Elantris. I think has really good positive themes that the heroes embody throughout the story. And so thinking of that, this 8/10 of the way lived up to that, if that makes sense. There weren't as many takeaway things for me. I think the themes were very good. And the story of Tress stepping out, being brave, and being bold to go after Charlie are all positive and great, and I appreciate that. But for me, I guess, like, the I think Elliot has talked about this before, and something that I would echo of, like, what am I taking home, like, what am I applying myself after this, you know? And there wasn't much of that element for me, though the themes of Tress herself I think were great.
I just want to add something real quick, because you just triggered something. Another thing that I love, sorry, this is my favorite part, was specifically, like you said, like, what would you take away from this? What I also took away from it is, you had also mentioned that, you know, she boldly goes out and goes, but not because Tress is a bold person, not because Tress is this secret hero who everyone's just waiting to blossom. It's that meme of, she's just a girl. She's just a girl. And she does the next thing that she can. And it's not, again, because she is secretly bonded to a spren and she doesn't know it, or she is whatever the Elantris, I forgot what the Elantris people do. She's not having these mystical powers. She's just a girl. And I really appreciate that. And especially in the midst of the Cosmere, of, we have all these wonderful, fantastic powers that are incredible, but I like that she's just a girl who's doing what she can for the man that she loves, one step at a time, discovering herself along the way. I'm done now, promise.
I really like what you said there, Alex. I agree with everything you said. I gave it a 8 out of 10 simply because it didn't challenge me anywhere. It didn't present anything that I hadn't heard before. And it's not trying to. It's not that I was expecting more from Tress. It's that I didn't put it down and I was like, wow, that was life changing. And it's not that it was intending to. I just put it at 8 out of 10. It was solid. I wasn't wowed by any of it, but it was enjoyable. So that's all I had.
I'm feeling slightly bad about my 7 now, because Alex, you may have convinced me here. What you said there was actually really genius. The simplicity of, it doesn't have to be universe changing to be important or memorable or worthwhile. And the fact that Tress is just doing the simple things and doing them honestly and earnestly and to the best of her ability is actually really fantastic in a very simple way. And so I resonate with a lot of that. I did put a lower score on this for similar reasons to what Paul and Trevor were just talking about. And I think, to try and just sum it up, I would say, for theme, I grade pretty harshly on theme, and I'm looking for, like, what is this story telling me? And I'm not sure that this story is, like, the type of story that's going to try to tell me anything too specific. It's a fun fairy tale with that genius, simple story or moral that I just mentioned, but there wasn't anything, Trevor said it, like earth shattering, that I set the book down and go, wow, I need to go reevaluate my life. I have read other books by Brandon Sanderson that have made me put it down and go, oh my, I need to go rethink my life. This just wasn't one of them. Not to take away from it, it was really good.
No, it's fair. And honestly, I do wonder if it almost, I would be curious talking to, not that you guys aren't great, but some other girls, and like to see if it's something that they had kind of noticed, because it felt like the most rom-com-y of something that he would do, yeah, for sure. That Sanderson would do. And so it's like, I took a lot from it, just from like doing the next thing and trying things to discover things I like. And anyway, but it is very different from a lot of his other stuff. And so I would be curious. I'm still trying to get several of my friends to read it, so we'll keep you posted.
My wife has picked this book up and put it down like 3 separate times, and she's gotten a little bit further each time. She's restarted it each time. So we'll get there eventually. All right. Pushing forward, since we went a little long-winded on that, it's in the outline is general thoughts, but we've already kind of done this. So let's do general highlights. Is there something in here that we haven't talked about yet that you wanted to do, make sure that we highlight as yes. we wrap up this book? Anyone can go. I already did mine, which was Hoyd as the narrator. I just really wanted to talk about that, but I already did. So anyone else want to go?
I do have one thought that I think it was really striking for me about this book, and it actually has nothing to do with any of the words in the book. It has to do with the actual design of the book itself. And by design, I want to say like the art, but even just more than the art. I think it's, what's his name? Help me, Trevor, at Dragon Steel helps Brandon this.
Isaac Stewart.
I remember going to a panel of his at Dragonsteel 2 years ago, where he talked about book design and the thought that he was putting into like the leather bound pieces. So I'm willing to bet this is, you know, a lot of his work that is going into this. There are some subtle but really brilliant aspects of this book that are so cool. I talked about it in one of the episodes. There's an art piece in the very middle of the book where they're sailing from the Verdant Sea into the Crimson mm-hmm. Sea, and you turn the page and there's this art piece where the whole one half of the book is green and the other half of the book is red, and the accent color of the ink changes as you go. And I just found that genius, that as you're going, the aesthetic visual elements of the book are showing you progression and showing you change as your characters are going through it, just in like the color choices and the chapter headings. And even down to like the simple stuff, like, I don't know if you guys noticed this or not, the front papers and the end papers, like the inside of the cover, the very first ones has Tress's two cups, the one with the butterfly and the other one that's like metal, I think, pewter maybe.
The tankard.
Yeah. At the beginning, it's just two cups. At the end, it's the same two cups again, but in the pewter tankard is Huck the Rat. And the butterfly one, you can't tell maybe on my camera here, but it's broken and been re-glued back together. Like just those kind of subtle elements. They're just like, man, the thought that went into the visual design of this book is really, really cool. And Yumi was awesome as well, but not quite to that level. Like the art, fantastic. Same thing here. Art is fantastic. But just these little clever design elements, really ingenious.
I'm glad you pointed out the second cup. I noticed that Huck was in the tanker, but I didn't notice that the teacup was glued back together. I hadn't seen that one. Well,
as far as a general highlight or observation on this book, I just want to point out that this feels like one of the most different books we've read. I think a lot of what Alex was saying about the story of our hero here, our heroine, Tress, is a normal person. She's not like becoming a shard. She's not bonding some ancient power. You know, she learns, you know, some magic, I guess, along the way and things like that. but it's out of a necessity or out of a need or a circumstance, not because she has this great big high destiny, but that she's kind of, I don't know, taking control of her life. And I think that is really neat. But the general feel of this book feels way more laid back and I guess a bit whimsical and fun. I think that's actually somewhat cheating because that's what Alex actually wrote in our outline some. But I just want to highlight that this book has a very different vibe. It has a very different approach from the other books we've read. And so I was just comparing it to like Elantris, let's say. But it's very difficult to compare these side by side and say which one has the better theme, right? I feel like this is not, yeah, it's just not quite equally comparable. And I think it's neat. I think that's some of the real fun of these secret projects and just something that I think is really just really neat that we get to kind of tinker around with since it is still Cosmere.
And your other general thought, you need to include it.
Dragon, good. Yes, I like dragon. Dragon, really cool. Dragon, very wise, know many things, and very cool, big, strong dragon.
Include more dragons.
Yes, more dragons in the future, please. It was cool.
Alex, did you have anything to highlight before we go to characters?
I think I got all that I really wanted to get out about my general highlights and the theme. I really feel like I just let out a lot of steam there on just what I really loved about this book. So that was generally kind of, yeah, I love this book and that's just my general thought. And it was even more enjoyable on the second read.
Sounds good. Moving on to favorite characters. I will go first. I put mine down as Hoyd. Because of the rant I already went on, but not necessarily Hoyd as a character, but what is done with Hoyd's character in this book, I think is really, really cool, which is why I put Hoyd's as my favorite character. But if I were to choose an actual character in the story, it would not be Hoyd. It would be Fort. I think Fort and his fascination with the deal, the hunt, getting cool deals out of Tress, even though he does genuinely care about Tress, and getting cool deals out of his crewmates, out of his fellow officers, even though deep down he's really trying his best and he really does care about everyone on the Crow's Song. I really love Fort.
I'm going to go ahead and hop in, even though I think going down the list, I think I'm the last person who wrote the favorite character. I said my favorite character is Tress. I think Tress is fantastic. She's the highlight character of this story. But really, I'm here because I want to call Trevor out. I think except for Stormlight specifically, he will not choose the protagonist of the story. The main protagonist is never his favorite character. It's always some... What? In Mistborn, it was Damu was like his
of favorite character. Of course it's Damu.
And I'm like, at the end, we're like, who is Damu? Can you remind us? You know, I did remember Damu. However, like, what? You have some serious explaining to do if you're like, out of all the characters that we've been following, learning from, like, oh, I just really okay. Trevor just looking for some attention here, and so I'm giving it to him.
You're right, and I'm accepting it. So I'm gonna get back on my Damu box, even though this is not the context for it. The reason why it's Damu is because Mistborn characters are not good. There are no good Mistborn characters. And I mean that by like a moral good. Okay. There are no moral good characters in Mistborn. Zero. That's why it's Damu, because he's just a guy. But anyway.
Just a guy.
Yes, it's Fort because he's just a guy. He's handling the things that are in front of him. He's taking care of who he can take care of. He's cooking because no one else knows how. It's Fort.
I appreciate hearing the thoughts. I'm giving you a hard time about it, but I understand.
I appreciate
it. But Tress is my favorite. I think she's the standout favorite. I mean, it is Tress of the Emerald Sea. She has that advantage. I guess the other secret projects are the only ones that have like the main characters like in the title, you know. The others, it's like a cool Warbreaker, you know, like title. So she is by far and large the protagonist, and I think she was a great protagonist, and so she was my favorite. If I'm given an honorable mention, I enjoyed Hoid's narration. I liked trying to pick apart, find little Easter eggs that he would mention. So Hoid might be my honorable mention.
Yeah, my favorite character is Tress. Again, we know why. I think she's phenomenal, and I thoroughly enjoyed watching her story and her journey and her thoughts behind it. She's just a girl, and I love her for it.
Well, if Trevor's in trouble for picking Fort, then I'm really in trouble for my selection. I would tell you that the best character in this book by a country mile, maybe a dozen country miles, is Tress, by far. Tress is excellent character. I really liked her a lot. I just didn't quite relate with her quite so much, or she wasn't as like convicting to me. So I was kind of left without a major favorite character coming out of this. And then I remembered to someone back to the very beginning, it's like chapter three, someone who gets like a grand total of two chapters of screen time, but who has actually really grabbed my attention for all the right reasons. And that was Tress's father, her dad. Do you guys remember back to that early chapter where Tress is like trying to figure out how to get off the island and she doesn't really know how, and she like goes to bed and her dad's like, okay, I'm going to make this happen. And he like goes to the tavern and cashes in all his favors that he's been owed by all these people. And just that image of a dad who's willing to spend all the relational rapport that he's built up with all of his friends for one crazy idea that his earnest daughter just threw at him because he trusts her, was like, wow, that's really cool. So I'm picking Tress's dad.
And what's his real name if he's your favorite character?
I don't even remember. This is terrible, isn't it? What is his name?
Glorfson. I'm just
kidding. Glorfson, son of Glorf.
Yeah. Family name.
I don't even remember his name either.
Yeah, if I want to claim it, I better look it up, but it's going to take me a while to find. So, yeah, unnamed Tress's dad.
While Elliot flips for that, you could just go to the Copper Mine and be in the 21st century and figure it out.
Yeah, that'd be way faster, huh?
All right, let's go to some favorite quotes. Briefly.
Lem.
Thank you. Lem. All right. Let's start with favorite quotes. Let's start with Paul, because it comes first in the book from the rest of these quotes.
Deal. Okay.
Technically, mine does actually.
We'll get
there. Oh, look, you found it.
Okay, so my favorite quote, I'll go ahead and read it, and then I'll share a little bit about why I really like this quote. This is on page 89, The Cabin Boy, for your record. It might seem that the person who can feel for others is doomed in life. Isn't one person's pain enough? Why must a person like Tress feel for two or more? Yet I've found that the people who are the happiest are the ones who learn best how to feel. It takes practice, you know, effort. And those who late in life have been feeling for 2, 3, or 1,000 different people, well, turns out they've had a leg up on everyone else all along. I think this is really neat because we talked about theme, and I think Alex mentioned it. It feels like Brandon Sanderson almost wrote in a lot of just like his thoughts, I guess, into this book, kind of snuck him in. And this kind of feels like one of those moments, the sentiment of empathy and the sentiment of caring for others is burdensome. But while it is a burden, it strengthens you and you kind of grow in your ability to care and have compassion for others and things like that. And so that was a pretty neat quote. Trevor, you're actually wrong though. Alex's quote actually was earlier in the book than mine.
Oh, I apologize.
Maybe I should have handed it over to her to read hers first. But one of them is. is.
I have two quotes. I have one serious quote, and then I have one that has that I actually, it's one of those commentaries that has support, that supports a hot take that I've had on a classic trope in stories that I get so mad about, and it supports it, and I'm really excited about it. But I'll do the sweet one first. So my favorite, like, legitimate quote is, I won't read the whole thing because it's quite a, it's a long imagery thing, but it's essentially at the very beginning of chapter three, well, kind of towards the end, when she said, and in fact, on the deepest level, it wasn't about cups or stories at all. It was instead about gloves. And I loved the imagery of her saying, of the, just the, what a well-worn glove, pair of gloves is like, how useful it is, how familiar and comforting it is, and then how it was just switched over to be like, and Charlie was like a pair of good gloves. And then later when they're leaving and he's like, I don't know how to describe this, Tress, but you're like, I don't know if this makes sense, but you're like a pair of gloves. And it just, it all made my little heart melt because I was like, they are like gloves. And I just think that is such a unique and beautiful, genuine look at what a relationship can look like. And I just, I love that exploration of it. And so that is by far my favorite quote. But the quote that supports my hot take. So let me tell you my hot take and then let me tell you what supports. Okay. I hate the hot take in, or I hate the trope when you're in, Spider-Man does it the most, but I noticed this also in Elantris. It made me so mad. Oh no. It was Mistborn Era 2. The hero goes off and the love interest comes up and is like, let me help. And he's like, no, it's too dangerous. Let me, I got to protect you. I got to keep you safe. Excuse me. If Paul is out there doing something, you better believe I'm going to be right there next to him. I don't care if I die. I want to do it next to him. Let me have my choice in that. And so basically there's two times. One, when Huck was like, I didn't tell you because I wanted to protect you. And Tress was like, that's awful. Why would you do that? I can make my own. It's basically, then Hoyt was like, basically me saying, I can't let you make your own decisions. But then the other one specifically was when Hoyt gives a little fun tip. Being told I kept you in the dark to protect you is not only frustrating, but condescending as well. It's a truly economical way to demean someone. If you're looking to fit more denigration into an already busy schedule, give it a try. So I just felt very validated in that it is to me, and it is basically saying, you don't trust me in decisions. Again, I get that it is like for love and protection that the hero is like, don't do it. But I will be by Paul's side no matter what. So can't stop me. So that's my hot take. Thank you.
That was very good. Thank you, Alex. All right, Elliot, do you have a couple?
My turn? I do. First one is about memories. I'll just go ahead and read it. This is Hoyt, of course, narrating. Memories have a way of changing on us, souring or sweetening over time, like a brew we drink, then recreate later by taste, only getting the ingredients mostly right. You can't taste a memory without tainting it with who you've become. That inspires me. We each make our own lore, our own legends every day. Our memories are our ballads. And if we tweak them a little with every performance, well, that's all in the name of good drama. The past is boring anyway. We always pretend the ideals and cultures of the past have aged like wine, but in truth, the ideas of the past tend to age more like biscuits. They simply get stale. And that quote is not like the normal quotes that I think I would pick. It's not, you know, one you might want to like live your life by. It was more just like such a cool description of memories and a different way to think about it, and just like very well said by Hoyt or Mr. Sanderson. I just thought it was a fun quote. My second one, which I need to flip to now, is maybe a little more serious, although I think it's still Hoyt talking, so I mean, how serious could it be? Page 349. See if I can find this one. Yeah, so this one is about heroism. Yeah, let me start here. This one's a little longer, but it's I think it's really good. Heroism is a remarkable thing, oft misunderstood. We all think we understand it because we want to see it seed inside ourselves. That is part of the secret, really. If you gather together stories of heroes, those who have risked their lives for others, those who have stood against overwhelming odds, those who have barreled heedlessly into danger with the aplomb of a champion diver leaping from the highest platform, you find patterns. Two of them, in fact. The first is that heroes can be trained, not by a government or a military, but by the people themselves. Heroes are the ones who have thought about what they're going to do and who have trained to do it. Heroism is often the seemingly spontaneous result of a lifetime of preparation. But if you ask these heroes why they risk their lives, don't do it on a stand in front of a crowd while you give them their medal, because the truth is they likely didn't do it for their country or even for their ideals. Consistently, across cultures, eras, and ideologies, war heroes report the same simple motivation. They did it for their friends. And yeah, I think that speaks for itself.
I would like to say that that's all great and all, but it completely works against, spoilers for the Way of Kings, Kaladin going back for Dalinar because he doesn't know Dalinar. He does it because he knows it's right. Just saying.
Wow. He would not make it on this planet, would he, Trevor?
I guess not. Kaladin would probably, yeah. He would probably die on this planet. He'd be sucking in Stormlight and sucking some spores and
yeah, die. It'd be over quick.
All right. Time for the question, which we have visited and revisited. I want a final answer from each of us. Would you recommend this book to a first-time Cosmere reader? Alex, I don't think your answer is going to change from the first time I asked you this. So if you want to recap yours, you can go ahead.
Yes, I would, because it's a, I don't know if you want an explanation, but you're going to get one. But the Way of Kings, if it's too much of a commitment, I think that this is a really good bite-sized, very simple, not overly complicated Cosmere book. And I understand that one particular line, but I read that before I had read Mistborn. And I have a very strong photographic memory of names and things like that. And I didn't even know to pay attention to it. I remember looking at it being like, I don't know what this means at all. And then I read Mistborn and I had no recollection that that was in Tress. So I think just don't mention it and I don't think people will notice it.
All right, Paul.
It's hard for me to find a definitive yes or no on its own answer. I think I would give this book to someone if I felt like it specifically matched their taste as a standalone book. I think if someone said was interested and they were like, yeah, I've heard a lot about Brandon Sanderson, I think it'd be neat. I'm, you know, interested in getting lost in a fantasy world or something like that. I don't think this is the book I would hand them. I think I would pick one of the other entry points, whether that be Mistborn or whether that be The Way of Kings or other things. One, I feel like this book, if you read this and then you try to pick up elsewhere, I think you're still starting from ground zero on whatever book you read next. There's not really much in this that gives you a connection or understanding of anything else other than, you know, you kind of toy around with Brandon's magic systems and things like that. However, I think the reason, I think what's holding this book back for me from giving this to a first-time reader is the magic system at hand. The spores and the imagery is awesome, but I feel like it's not the most, especially if it's someone who isn't much of a high fantasy reader. If they're not, which if they are, then they've probably already read a Brandon Sanderson book at some point. Not always, but you know, I feel like the spores and the ethers and all the stuff going on might be a bit tough to follow. I could be totally wrong, but that's my image of it compared to whenever you learn about and are introduced to Stormlight or introduced to metals or things like that. Those feel like more kind introductions. I feel like the spores is a bit harder to get behind. So all in all, I think no. I think 49 out of 50 times, I don't think I would give this to a first-time reader. However, if I knew the person's taste and this type of story is something that would interest them, such as Alex, I would probably give this to her if as a first time reader, but not to just anyone.
Elliot.
I'm going to agree with Paul pretty much completely here. I think I'm not worried about spoilers. I think the spoilers you might get out of this are going to be out of context enough to a first-time reader that it's not going to matter. What you cannot do is start Mistborn, set it down, pick this book up, and then go back to Mistborn. That will ruin some things for you. But as long as you don't do that, I think the spoilers are fine. So I think you can hand this to a first-time Cosmere reader, but I think personally for me, I'm going to very rarely suggest this as a first book to start with for all the reasons that Paul just said. Of, I don't think this is a good sample of Brandon Sanderson. And when I say good, I don't mean quality. I mean, it's not representative of the bulk of his work. And so if Tress is all you've ever read, you're going to think Brandon's work is something very different than it is. And so for some people, I think that might even mislead them or give them some weird expectations going into the rest of the Cosmere. So if someone is like ready to dive into the Cosmere, I'm not so sure Tress is actually a great place for them to start, just because it's going to kind of point them off in a weird direction. That said, if I've got someone who is never going to read the Stormlight Archive because they're just never going to read a book that big, they're not interested in that, their tastes are elsewhere, they like a more lighthearted rom-com type of thing, and Tress is going to be something they like, yeah, absolutely. I'm going to suggest this one, but it's probably not going to be my go-to.
I want to add one other deep thing. I think if it was someone who I'm trying to get interested in the Cosmere and I'm trying to tailor to their interests or something like that, I think I would be more inclined to hand them Yumi if I felt like their interests were in line with that story than Tress. While I still don't think Yumi is like my top choice for an entry point, I think if you read that, I feel like the way that the story flows and the interactions and all, just the layout of the plot, I think is far more in line and would prepare you much more well for the other books. I'm thinking, you know, whatever, pick your poison, Mistborn, Stormlight, Warbreaker. I think there's many places that you could get an introduction and go from there.
Unfortunately, for the content of this podcast, I have the same exact answer that Paul and Elliot have. Would I give this to a very specific person as their first Cosmere book? Yes. But more times than not, there are things in this book that will disqualify it as a first Cosmere book. Is it possible? Yes. But for what Elliot just said, it's not a good sample for Sanderson if I'm trying to get them into Sanderson. Or there's a couple disqualifying things for the flavor of the Cosmere, like Hoyd being the narrator, for example. I don't want to have the wrong reader pick up Tress and then not pick up another Cosmere book, whereas if they picked up The Way of Kings, they would have tore through the entire Cosmere and not cared about Hoyd as a narrator once they've got there. So, is it possible? Yes. And will I get to that point with someone? Yes. I think I will give Tress to someone. I don't think it would be my default entry point when recommending. It would either be The Way of Kings or Elantris for me specifically. So, all right. Any more closing thoughts on Tress before we tease a little Sunlit? Speak now or forever.
Dragon, good. That's my last thing to say. Dragon was good.
Good. Dragon, good.
I'll just add, it's really fun to watch Brandon Sanderson unchained. To watch him just like, I can just tell reading this book that he had fun writing it. and and that makes it enjoyable to read. And so that, yeah, enjoyable. That's the word for the book.
Sounds good. Alex, the last time we spoke, you had not read Sunlit Man by Brandon Sanderson. You have since informed me that you have read Sunlit Man by Brandon Sanderson. Quick 30-second non-spoilers, your thoughts on the book.
It was about what I thought it would be, but better than I thought it would be. I didn't think I was going to be that in tune with, not that in tune, like I didn't think I'd be that engaged in the story, and I very much was, and I enjoyed it way more than I thought I would, but it's still about what I was expecting it would be. Wise. I'd try not to be spoilery, but it's about what I thought it would be, but I enjoyed it a lot more, and I have a lot of questions that I can't ask. So.
All right, Paul, what do you know about Sunlit Man?
I know that my knowledge is that Sunlit Man is Stormlight adjacent.
Correct.
Slightly unclear on what that means. However, I'm assuming it's either someone from Roshar or we're on Roshar. Don't know time frame. And my understanding is it's like maybe we're following the Sunlit Man. And then later on, we'll find out who the Sunlit Man is, and that'll be something really cool. We'll be like, oh my gosh, I can't believe it was Lopin's brother. I don't remember, Huyo or whatever.
Huyo.
Yeah, or cousin or whoever it was. I can't believe that. That's really crazy.
Yeah, sure.
But yeah, that, my understanding is it's more serious, dark, brooding style. This is more happy Tress, you know, and this will be more emo.
Elliot, what do you know about Sunlit Man?
Pretty much the same. Stormlight adjacent. I've not taken it out of the shrink wrap yet. It's on my bookshelf, still in the shrink. But even just looking at that outer cover, and specifically the standout to me is like the pages, like the sides of the pages are black in the book. I've never owned a book that had black pages on the side. Yeah, look at that picture on Trevor's camera if you're watching our YouTube cool. Here. Like that. Oh yeah, it's cool, but it immediately just sets this like intense tone for me of, oh man, things are gonna go down. Ooh, we got some art coming our way. Ooh, it's like Mordor. It's like Mordor.
Yeah, Mordor or something.
Looks like Mordor.
Sorry, all brings right. A power on the mind. But yeah, so I'm expecting something like, you know, maybe a little more. I actually don't like this term because I think most people define it really poorly, but like gritty. Something that's maybe a little more kind of down and in, a little more hero's going to be under pressure. Not like Tress, where it's a little more, let's see what happens today, even though she is on a rather dangerous planet like we talked about. I'm expecting something a little more intense. The stakes are going to be higher, and maybe the Cosmere impacts are going to be greater as well. I'm actually really excited.
That last comment was actually the next question I was going to ask. What is your level of interest in Sunlit Man out of 10? Are you really excited to be there? Are you reading it because it's the last Cosmere book that we have to cover? Where are we at?
It's funny that you asked that question on the eve of release of Wind of Truth. Wind and Truth. Because I kind of want to jump to, you know, like 10 out of 10. I'm super excited for Sunlit Man. I want to do it. But then I think about like, oh, hold on a second. What scale are we working with? Because the 10 out of 10 is Wind and Truth. Wind sure. And Truth is like, I think about that thing once a day and trying to figure out what in the world is in store for us as we embark on Stormlight Archive 5. So Sunlit Man is like a step down from that. So 8.5 out of 10 is the interest level and readiness to pick up that one and go.
My interest level in Sunlit Man has slowly grown. It's grown because I don't know anything that happens, but the context clues of the way people talk about the book makes me think that there's going to be more relevance, more Cosmere relevance, more things that we're going to really like theorize on, and, you know, really like Cosmere, Stormlight 5, maybe predictions or things like that. So for that reason, it's gone up. I know before we read any Secret Projects, my interest levels were first were Yumi, and then I guess Tress and Sunlit Man were kind of tied in my mind. Honestly, maybe Tress above Sunlit. I didn't have a natural affinity towards like the style. I think it's grown on me. I haven't even started it, but just the aesthetic, the black pages, everything has definitely grown on me, and so I'm very, very interested. And especially with it being the last book that we're reading, it almost, I don't know how intentional it was that this is the last book that we're reading. I don't remember all the planning, and we've been reading books for so long now that, you know, who knows. But it almost feels like it's been saved to the end for a reason in my head of like, you know, what crazy thing are we still going to have to find out? So my expectations are solid, honestly, like 9 out of 10. I have maybe more set high hopes for this book than the other Secret Projects. This one, I feel like there should be more relevance. The only reason I have for saying that is because I've thought it. I don't have any solid reason as to why, like, other than it being Stormlight adjacent. Its relevance. I don't know if I can throw Alex under the bus again, but she said when she finished the book, and I we didn't talk about it at all and stuff to make sure I don't get spoiled, but she did say that she thinks Elliot will particularly like this book. I don't know if I'm allowed to say that, but
ooh.
And I have guesses as to why, but nothing confirmed. So,
but I was reading, I was like, yeah, I have a sneaky suspicion.
That makes me think that there's going to be some engineering stuff. That's my only guess.
Well, so now I'm at 9 out of 10. We're up to 9 out of 10.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah.
Next week, we will be covering only chapters 1 and 2, just the briefest peek at Sunlit before we really dive in. So, go ahead.
So it won't even be the Sunlit Man yet. It'll be like the sunrise.
It'll just be the
pre-dawn man.
Yeah,
just the S.
Yeah, dawn man.
Twilight man.
Yeah, not even fully sunlit yet. It's just barely going to be the sunrise peeking over the horizon, man. That's sort of the title episode. Barely peeking over sun, barely peeking over the horizon, man.
Paul, you are more right than you can actually imagine.
Okay. I really do want to go read it.
All right, chapters 1 and 2 of the Sunlit Man next week. Our final book before Wind and Truth in December. Thanks for joining me, Paul, Elliot, and Alex. We will reconvene next week.
On we go.
Sir, yes, sir.